A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello there, movie truthers. It's Michael Leader here, wishing you a very happy new year with a remotely recorded Truth and Movies special. A very special one, in fact, this time, because this is the first time I think we've had all three of the core members of the editorial team of Little White Lies on the same podcast with me. So let me welcome David Jenkins, head honcho.
Hey.
Adam Woodward.
Hey.
And Hannah Woodhead.
Hi.
Happy New Year, everyone. Let's hope that 2021 is packed with great movies for all of us. We wanted to start the year with a very special episode in a similar vein to one we did at the back end of December, celebrating a filmmaker. And actually, the filmmaker in question almost rhymes with the filmmaker we spoke about last time. Last time we spoke about David Fincher, and this episode, because of his 75th birthday, we're going to be talking about David Lynch, a filmmaker maybe some of our listeners may have heard of and seen films by or TV series by over the years. I suppose we're going to do what we did with David Fincher. We've all come with one film each that we'd like to talk about. But first of all, let's get acquainted. Let's talk about our first taste of David Lynch and maybe our general feelings about him and his films. So I'll go first. I'm very much of the generation where so many cultural touchstones were introduced to me by parodies on The Simpsons. And I very clearly remember two of the Twin Peaks parodies that appeared on The Simpsons during their golden era, particularly the bit where Homer Simpson is up late watching Twin Peaks and there's a lady dancing backwards with a horse and he says, "Brilliant, I have no idea what's going on," which is certainly one overarching, unifying take on David Lynch, maybe. But then I see David Lynch almost in a similar vein to Tim Burton and Quentin Tarantino for sort of a young teenage wannabe film fan. They're, because they are, they almost present an entire film school within their own filmography. So you hit a certain age and you want to be sort of slightly challenged and weirded out by elements of art house or artistic or absurdist cinema, surreal cinema, and that's where you go to David Lynch, where he's looking beneath the surface of society. So I remember very rosy-tinted nostalgic memories of going home from school on a Friday, getting the bus through Manchester, going to the recently opened FOP during the golden age of the £3 or £5 DVD section, where all it seemed like all David Lynch's films were a fiver at the time, and I'd pick up one a week and slowly make my way through his filmography. So that was my introduction to David Lynch. David, what was yours?
I think the first time I heard, I don't think I'd heard the name David Lynch for a while, but I think that the first kind of entry point into his world was probably Eraserhead, which is obviously his debut. Like, and the reason being is because my dad was a massive fan of the film. And I think he had been to, like, you know, he'd been to see it at the Scala many times, which was this kind of, underground cinema in King's Cross that showed these kind of cult films on print. And I remember my dad getting very excited by the fact that Eraserhead was being released on video and that he would be able to rent it from our video shop or even, like, buy it from, like, WH Smith's or HMV or something like that. And he was very excited by the prospect of being able to, like, physically own a copy of Eraserhead. I think he's of that generation where that film was, you know, super, super important in what it represented as a kind of complete mad folly debut that is kind of this very distinct artist's vision and works on all these, as most of his films do, works on these kind of multiple levels. And I remember like him being very, you know, him sort of saying, no, you can definitely not watch this, when I was maybe like, you know, 8 or 9, and very much associating this idea of like this film being kind of forbidden and difficult, even though the name Eraserhead was obviously seemed quite weird and funny to me. I remember one time staying up long enough to see the beginning bit where you've got the Henry character like walking around in this weird kind of urban desolation, like these big piles of rubble, and he's sort of like walking in all these weird, like it's almost that kind of silent comedy style. And yeah, I remember that, and then just sort of being ushered off after that point, because things, you know, before he arrives at his girlfriend's house, things start to get kind of really strange and quite sort of sick, if I recall rightly. But yeah, that was my first take, and I didn't really, you know, I must admit that he's someone who I've only really, really got into quite recently. He's a filmmaker who's definitely, I've watched films, not thought very much of them, come back to them, watch them again, like them, watch them again, gone a bit cool, watch them again and love them. You know, like every viewing of a film is very, very different and brings new things. And I think that's what's so great about his back catalogue and worthy of this discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam, what was yours?
Well, now I think about it, The Simpsons is a good shout. but I have a very, very foggy memory as a child of watching The Elephant Man with my dad. And I'm not sure whether I watched the whole thing, but I have a very distinct memory. I think for years I didn't really know what the film was. It was one of those kind of late night Channel 4 reruns. And I vividly remember the opening scene, or it's kind of like the weird pre-credit sequence where there's this very surreal moment with the elephants, and there's a kind of, it's almost like implied that this woman was attacked or perhaps like sexually assaulted by like a herd of elephants. And I really, really distinctly remember that scene. And then it would have been, I mean, it was years later that I eventually saw the film properly. But in my mind at the time, it may as well have been a film from like the 1920s or 1930s or something. Like it very much felt like, you know, watching something that was very, very old and very alien and exotic to me in that way. And then it was not long after that, I actually weirdly picked up a copy of Blue Velvet on Laserdisc.
Wow.
At a car boot sale, not knowing anything about the film, not knowing who David Lynch was, not being able to play Laserdisc. I mean, this was like well before my time in terms of its relevance as a medium. I mean, hence it being, you know, picked up for probably 50p at a car boot sale. But I remember picking that up and being just like fascinated by the front cover. I think it was like the classic shot of a topless Kyle MacLachlan holding Isabella Rossellini. And I just remember being really, quite captivated by that image and not really knowing much about it. And then I think after that, it was, as with a lot of people, I kind of got into Twin Peaks in college and, you know, would have like very crude Twin Peaks gifs on my MySpace page back in the day, and quotes from it from the show and things like that. And I think actually the first Lynch film I actually watched in the cinema was probably the one I'm going to be talking about later. Okay. Not at the time it was released, some years later, but it's the one I've seen the most and the one I've seen in the cinema the most.
It's funny that you mentioned Twin Peaks there, because Twin Peaks was always the hardest one to get when I was a teenager, finding all these films, because it was quite a while for it to finally come to the UK, you know, Region 2 DVD, particularly the second season. I remember a friend of mine had like a 360 pixel AVI file of the pilot episode that we used to watch while we were waiting for the DVDs to come out. And it's amazing to think all those old folkies talking about VHS and Laserdisc and DVDs.
Well, Hannah. I don't know when the first... Sorry, I was going to say, I don't know when the second season or even the first season came out on DVD, but I do remember it was available around the time I was kind of getting into it and starting to watch it, because it was definitely not on, as far as I know, it wasn't really shown on UK television.
Yeah, I had to import
at that time as a kind of rerun.
Yeah, but enough from the old fogies. Hannah, what was your first taste of Lynch?
I think I was always quite resistant to him because I saw it very much as like a male kind of like film bro thing, which is strange because the way I got into film mostly was through picking up stuff at my local library and kind of being on social media. So the early days of like Tumblr and LiveJournal were the really like where I first discovered the world of film, and I got into Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino that way. But David Lynch somehow didn't kind of, I don't know, I just didn't, I saw it as a much more kind of like a gatekept thing, where it just seemed totally kind of like put on this massive pedestal in a way that, you know, Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino films are as well, by a certain type of bro-y, my first film school type of teenager, I guess. So for a long time, I was really resistant for that reason, and also because my mum is a really big fan of The Elephant Man, and I just had this like really enduring memory of like throughout my teenage years when I was getting into film, she was just like, "Are you going to watch The Elephant Man?" And I was like, "My mum doesn't know anything about cinema. I'm not going to take her recommendations." So I was really like, "No, I'm not going to. I don't have any like interest in this," which was a real like cutting off my nose to spite my face, because when I finally did kind of, I think it must have been Twin Peaks that I finally, it was the first thing I watched. I think it was the early days of Netflix. It was kind of one of the first things they had available. And I remember sitting down and watching the whole first season and being like, oh, this is properly like, very, very good. And I think that was probably my first year of university. So I would have been 18 and this would have been 2011. So he'd not kind of made anything for a little while by that point, about 5 years. So I was kind of came to him in the I don't want to say dead space, but the years between Inland Empire and the Twin Peaks: The Return. And then I watched Blue Velvet, I think it was the first film I actually sat down and watched. But I'm still like, there's still a lot of gaps in my like Lynch knowledge. I'm by no means an expert, by no means a kind of devotee, but I think for me, like, the thing I really love is Lynch himself. Like, I'm just fascinated by the man and all the kind of like mythology around him, all the little like weird stories that you find on the internet about him. My favorite is the one about him and his Woody Woodpecker collection. He I'm sure that listeners will know this, but if they don't, there's a wonderful story which if you search it, it's like the first thing that'll come up about him finding I think 5 Woody Woodpecker like soft toys on the side of the road and taking them home and adopting them. And there's a wonderful photo of this, but then in the article it says with a grim finality, "They are not in my life anymore." Which is just like such a kind of a twist that you're not expecting with that story. And for me, that kind of that weirdness but also that humor is what I really I think connected with. And yeah, Simpsons references as well is kind of the big way that I think he kind of floated into my consciousness. But yeah, out of the four of us, I think I'm definitely the kind of the newest person to come to Lynch. And I'm still like on that journey. I've still got things of his I need to watch. Mm.
I do wonder, maybe somebody with a more of a bird's eye view of the last 40 years of cinema could tell us this, but I do wonder when that sort of vision of Lynch solidified, that sort of gatekept film bro, this is why you've got to watch Lynch thing came in. Because thinking back to when me and my friends growing up, we had various ways of getting into him. My sci-fi nerd friends loved Dune. My sort of new metal, industrial metal friends loved Lost Highway because of the Trent Reznor, Marilyn Manson, Rammstein connection in that film. So there are lots of roots in, and he's a very, you know, you try and, you know, paint a portrait of David Lynch, and there's so many facets to him. He's not just the one thing. So maybe we'll hit upon that when we have our individual picks and the various faces of the man. So maybe we should dive into our individual picks. So we'll go chronologically, and I'm going to come straight back to you, Hannah, because yours is the first one. What film have you picked?
I've chosen Wild at Heart, which, I don't know, when we were asked to, when this conversation about this podcast came up and we were deciding what films we do, it's just instantly the one that I was like, yeah, that's the one I want to do. There was no kind of like real question for me. And I was thinking last night, I don't really know why I had that instantaneous reaction, because I don't think it's one that a lot of people would necessarily gravitate towards. But I'm, again, like, one of the great things about Lynch as a filmmaker is I think if you ask anyone who is a fan of his, they'll give you a different answer. It's not like there's one film that is, or one show that is considered to be his like defining work. And I think he himself would be quite pleased with that. I think that he has always kind of tried to cast his net as far as can be in terms of genre and themes. And I was surprised myself by this choice. Because reading about it again and watching it again last night, I was like, this is a real, like, this is a journey, this film, in terms of, like, the film itself, but also the context of it, you know, the kind of, where it fits in his filmography and the reaction to it at the time. I think it's a really interesting part of his career. And I was thinking last night, you know, when the Palme d'Or, it was the second in, or the first, no, it was the first in a 3-year streak for the US where David Lynch won the Palme d'Or, and then Steven Soderbergh won for, I'm going to get the order wrong, someone's going to correct me, but Sex, Lies and Videotape, and then in 92, I can't remember who won, but it was that kind of, like, mad, bad, dangerous male auteurs phase of US cinema, which I think we've not seen for quite some time, maybe. And it got this kind of, you know, kind of weird reaction at Cannes, where it was booed, like quite famously booed. And then it won the Palme d'Or, and then it came out in the US, and the reaction to it was very mixed. I think that Roger Ebert was particularly critical of it. It got a lot of like 1.5 star reviews, and it's one of those that's definitely undergone a sort of like reevaluation in the past 20 years, I guess, since it came out. And the last year was its 20th anniversary, so it had a lot of you know, think pieces saying, oh, why Wild at Heart is actually the best Lynch film. And yeah, I just had this real sort of appreciation, being a bit of a magpie myself and kind of really enjoying picking and choosing from pop culture. I think the satirical bent of this film is something that really appeals to me.
It's something that fascinates me that as a Lynch fan for many years, I saw Wild at Heart as a footnote, as the film he was making when Twin Peaks season 2 went off the rails. And then he comes back afterwards and for the final stretch. But Hannah, I want to know what you think of Laura Dern in this film as the creator of the Laura Dern zine. And of course, Laura Dern being so important to Lynch's films.
Yeah, I mean, where do we even begin? I think the film that I always like that compare this to, and I think that's no kind of shock, is Natural Born Killers. And I think that obviously that comes quite a while after this film, and I think often gets Wild at Heart gets overshadowed by the reputation of Natural Born Killers. But if you compare like what Juliette Lewis if you compare what Juliette Lewis is given to do in that film with what Laura Dern is given to do in Wild at Heart, there's like no comparison to me. Laura Dern is kind of the heart of Wild at Heart. She's so magnetic in this role of Lula, the kind of I want to say damsel in distress, but I think she really like is so self-empowered throughout this film. I want to say, like, it's, you know, she's a character that she has an extremely domineering mother, and she's a victim of sexual abuse when she's younger, but never once is she presented as a kind of like, you know, submissive character. She's always like this very self-assured, very like kind of self-possessed woman who knows what she wants and is very determined to get it. And that, I think, is, you know, one of Lynch's kind of, one of the things I love most about Lynch is that he really like writes a good female character. He writes an interesting female character. He writes female characters that I like care about and, you know, want to know more about. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about Twin Peaks later, but like Audrey Horne is one of my kind of favorite, like when I was a teenager, like Pinterest, like worthy inspiration moments. And yeah, I think that the same with Lula Pace Fortune. I think it's such a kind of iconic Lynchian role for me. And I think maybe gets overshadowed a little bit with Wild at Heart because she's up against Nicolas Cage, which is quite a like a hard like a hard thing to do, go up against his like kind of manic energy. But yeah, I really I love her in this film. I think that first like I'd forgotten how wild the first like 2 minutes of this film are until I rewatched it, and I was like, literally 2 minutes in, we get Nicolas Cage like beating a man to death with his bare hands, and she's there like screaming, like full body kind of like wailing into the camera. Another thing that Lynch really like loves to do is make Laura Dern like scream into the camera. And yeah, I've lost my train of thought there, but yeah, that first 2 minutes I think really kind of like sets you up on this like, okay, we are in it right from the word go with this film, which I think is really like thrilling to me.
Hannah, can I ask a very quick question? Just to interrupt very quickly. Have you ever seen the Wogan interview with Nick Cage?
No.
So I'm sure it's on YouTube, but basically like he comes on to do like Nick Cage is on Terry Wogan to do an interview promoting Wild at Heart, and he basically does the interview in character as Sailor Ripley, including he walks down the shiny staircase and into the little kind of alcove where the seating is, and he starts doing like shadow boxing and slam dancing, and it's completely mad. But it's a very cool, I think, like I always remember that as something like you can tell that the people who are making the, like as they were making the film, that, and you get it from watching it, that everyone was really into it, everyone was really invested in who they were and what they were doing and why they were doing it.
Wild at Heart for me is such a film of moments, and they just keep bubbling up into my brain as you're talking, Hannah, and particularly the Nicolas Cage dancing scenes to the whatever speed metal band, whatever it is, with all the strobe lighting. That's definitely a highlight for me. But David, Adam, are you big fans of Wild at Heart? Any immediate thoughts on that film?
Yeah, I think it's like you said, Michael, it's one I sort of came to quite late, I think. Maybe not the last of his I watched, but yeah, certainly wasn't one that was kind of high up on my list. And there's, yeah, as you say, it really is a film of like the amazing memorable moments, as I think, to be fair, a lot of Lynch's work is. And I just think his the way he sketches and fleshes out characters, obviously with the help of the actors, is just so amazing. And I think maybe this is the film where that really comes to the fore, especially with, as you said, Laura Dern and Cage, but also Willem Dafoe's character is just amazing. I mean, what an incredible villain.
Bobby Peru,
such a good name as well. This is a movie of great names as well, I think, like, it must be said. Like, I don't know how much credit Lynch gets in general for his naming, but like, he has some real, like, some great character names in all his work. And one thing I must say as well about Wild at Heart, I think, like, it's kind of in the title, but I don't think it really occurred to me until last night when I was rewatching this, but Lynch is such a romantic. I don't think he gets enough credit for that. Like, people talk about how weird his films are and how kind of, like, you know, Lynchian has become this, like, this word for just meaning weird, basically. But he's, you know, he really believes in Love Conquers All, which is, like, it's so nice, you know, to see an author who believes that. And I think in Wild at Heart, there's this real, like, for all the kind of, like, pastiche and violence, like, there's this real, really pure relationship at the centre of it. And it is about, like, a couple who are determined to be together no matter, like, what the odds. And I think the last, like, 10 minutes is so kind of... so I genuinely had, like, a, like, oh no moment when it looks like they're not going to end up together. I think it's, like, it's such a fun movie, but also, like, yeah, there is such a kind of, like, pureness to it, and a pureness to the central relationship amid all this, like, gunfire and sexual assault and assassins trying to kill Nicolas Cage. I think it's a real, like, it's a love story at the end of the day.
Amazing costumes as well.
Oh, well, yeah, the jacket. We haven't even talked about the jacket.
That's his own pod, I think.
I would say that I rewatched it fairly recently, and I would say it's probably not the first film that I would reach to of his to rewatch. I think it's kind of like maybe sort of stretches the bounds of the kind of wackiness and seriousness to a kind of Twin Peaks season two level at times, that makes it hard to kind of maybe for me to fully invest in, but. It's probably the film of his that I, if there was like a David Lynch season and I was programming it and I was like picking the slot for like Friday night at 10 o'clock, I'd probably go for like, you know, Wild at Heart. Actually, probably any of his films would probably work in that slot. But, you know, if I'd probably want to go to see Wild at Heart in that context and, you know, with a kind of bunch of rowdy folk at a cinema.
So David, what's your pick and where in your David Lynch program would you program it?
Yeah. Well, I think that, like, so I've picked 1992's Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which is just, I mean, there are probably many candidates for his most horrendously troubling film, but this is definitely got to be up there, and I think of all these films, or of all his films, I think a lot of the time I'm dazzled by the form, and how the sort of ideas are delivered, like films like Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire. I think I think that you kind of get through them by being kind of dazzled by the visual ideas and motifs. I think with Fire Walk With Me is for me his most raw film and maybe his most kind of humane. So just to give a bit of context, you've had the two series of Twin Peaks that came out in 1992. There's a kind of revelation early on in the second series which answers this perennial question that has kind of haunted the series from the first episode of who killed Laura Palmer, this person who we think is a kind of sweet homecoming queen who has been kind of bludgeoned and thrown in a river, and the series is this investigation about, you know, who killed her and why. And it's kind of revealed halfway through in the second series, because the producers were keen to not have that revelation basically like drag on any further. And basically when that happened, Lynch kind of got bored and went off and did other things, namely Wild at Heart. And then he kind of came back for the final episode, which is kind of maybe like the best episode of the entire series in total. But it's, but then he decided to make Fire Walk With Me, because I mean, he's talked about how he basically loves being in that world of Twin Peaks and just wanted to stay in there for a bit longer. And that's, I think that's a reason why he decided to make the third series of Twin Peaks more recently. And I think that the reason why he said that he liked it is not necessarily because he likes the characters and he likes the landscape and he likes the feel, but he finds that world and those people completely inspiring for him. And like when he thinks about those people, he gets ideas and he wants to tell stories about them. So Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, probably worth mentioning actually, because he's been name checked a few times. So the film premiered in Cannes in 1992 and was booed, which was his follow up to the sort of Palme d'Or winning Wild at Heart, so I think that maybe compounded the disappointment somewhat. Apparently Quentin Tarantino was at that screening in Cannes, and someone interviewed him in 92, and he came out and said something like, "Okay, I David Lynch has failed as an artist. I'm no longer engaging with his work. That film was complete trash," which is kind of unexpected, really, because you kind of think that he might, you know, as the sort of perennial trash magpie that he is, then you'd kind of expect him to maybe like see some value in this kind of extremely strange and weird and extreme film. It is kind of understandable, because like I think you need to basically have quite a detailed knowledge of the Twin Peaks and the machinations and the characters to really fully grasp Fire Walk With Me and what is happening. Essentially, it's what you have is like a kind of 30-minute prologue, which is very, very discombobulating and confusing, even if you do know the Twin Peaks world, which is looking into the death of a woman called Teresa Banks and two FBI agents similar looking to Carl McLaughlin's Dale Cooper, who are doing this investigation around them, which kind of you can see some echoes of the Twin Peaks story, but the connections aren't entirely there yet. And then for the second half, the second kind of hour and a half of the film, we're basically charting the week before Laura Palmer's death, and it all circles around this what it's basically kind of monitoring Laura Palmer, her actions, her dream life, her fantasies, her nightmares, and you know it's essentially kind of it's a really I find genuinely melancholy, upsetting movie about a kind of a woman dealing with this abuse that she has kind of had meted on her for years and years, to the point where she is kind of inventing people, inventing reasons, inventing ways of how to like deal with it, to the point where she is actually kind of doing it to other people and becoming like selling herself off as a kind of sexual object. She's performed by Cheryl Lee, who is kind of has a small but super important role in Twin Peaks. She is this kind of absence, a kind of ghostly presence who you kind of see in videos of her doing cheerleading and, you know, in sort of occasional dream sequences, but she's presented as this quite ambiguous presence. And even throughout the series, even though it's hinted that she had this dark side to her, the dark side that we see in, and the tormented side that we see in Fire Walk With Me is, you know, infinitely more extreme and dark and distressing than we could ever imagine. And that's maybe something that is a very, you know, when we say Lynchian, I think that kind of, you know, that kind of culmination of darkness and light existing at the same time in the same person in the same place is that's what it makes me think of. And I think that this film definitely has that. Like, it's definitely a film that every time I watch it, I get something more from it. I kind of love it that little bit more. I think it's it's maybe part of it. You can even, I think, like, Women in Trouble is something that Lynch comes back to again and again, like, especially particularly later on in Mulholland Drive and Inland Empire, and this film really kind of starts that, like, these women sort of coming apart at the seams, entering dream worlds or these kind of liminal spaces. And yeah, there's a really horrifically unwatchable sequence in the middle of the film that lasts about 10 minutes where Laura and her friend Donna, who is also this kind of sweet, pretty schoolgirl, go to the Double D bar, the Double Diamond bar, which is in Canada. Everything bad in the film happens in Canada. It's where the strip clubs are. It's where the prostitutes are. It's where the drugs come from. It's very weirdly anti-Canadian film. There's this, it's that they're kind of drugged and they're sort of having sexual things happening and screaming and drinking and leering, and all the while there's this kind of like blues rock, really kind of slow, sludgy blues rock riff in the background that kind of just makes it even more unbearable. It's definitely kind of got a feel of the sort of thing that Gaspar Noé ends up doing, like making these kind of showing these really horrific scenes, but using like soundtrack and music to really kind of pummel them home to just make them almost kind of unbearable. And the fact that it's happening to this person who you kind of have got this hint of, like, that she's kind of that her erratic behavior is the product of like years and years of abuse. You know, it makes the whole sequence seem even more kind of tragic. But yeah, no, I'll stop there. But yeah, it's a fave.
It's not one to throw on casually on a Monday evening. You need to be in a particular mood to watch and rewatch it. Something that I'm interested in is, for so many years, it was the end point of Twin Peaks, and for fans of the series, some couldn't look past the sort of necessities of the production. Like Kyle MacLachlan said, "I'll only come back, but I only want to be in half the film." So that's almost informs the restructuring and bringing in of Chris Isaac. Likewise, they recast Donna, don't they? Is it Donna they recast in Fair Walk With Me? But now it's the fulcrum around which the original run of Twin Peaks and The Return revolves around. So I've not rewatched it since then. Have you rewatched it since then, David?
The Return.
Have you rewatched Fire Walk With Me since The Return?
Yeah, no, I've rewatched it like just yesterday. So yeah, but it's actually very interesting in that there are lots of sequences and scenes revisited in The Return that feel like they're explicitly from Fire Walk With Me. Certainly scenes that take place in the scenes that take place in Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me has a kind of gateway vibe in that it's kind of, I mean, you know, the one thing that Fire Walk With Me does that I think maybe upset the fans is that it kind of dispenses with any of the whimsical stuff, to the point where characters who may have seemed like kind of strange and funny and quirky, like Jacques, this kind of corpulent bar owner, is just now seems like the kind of pinnacle of evil. There's nothing whimsical about it. Even like, you know, Leyland Palmer, who is kind of revealed to be like, you know, spoiler, you know, this abusive father who channels this evil, you know, who is either schizophrenic channeling this evil spirit, or maybe even Laura is channeling it to sort of shield herself from the fact that she's been receiving this abuse from her father. It kind of like sets up the kind of nastiness of the third series, which is less whimsical and less soap op, like less kind of like pastiche soap opery like the like the original series, and it's more, it is sort of darker, and the, and it, it does have humor, but it's more kind of like very dry, ironic humor, mm-hmm. than kind of, you know, that genuinely kind of silly, funny stuff that Lynch, I think, does a lot of. I mean, which I think is even visible in, like, I mean, I think that like Lost Highway and Wild at Heart are both like really funny films, whereas this is like Firewalk with Me, mm-hmm. is very militantly, you know, this is no funny stuff.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Well, if you want whimsy, I have the Lynch film for you, and that's The Straight Story, from 1999. It almost feels like in the 90s he split the atom of what we see as Lynchian, that light and darkness, and Fire Walk With Me is concentrated in the dark side and the light side is concentrated in The Straight Story. And it's one where I find almost the story behind The Straight Story inseparable from the film itself. It's based on a true story of this 73-year-old man who on his lawnmower drives 250 miles to visit his brother who's just had a stroke. And the script was developed by Mary Sweeney, David Lynch's long-term editor, producer and one-time partner. And she came to him with the script, and he connected to not just the characters but the landscape of Iowa and Wisconsin. And he got the money, got final cut. It was a low budget, and it seems like a very sort of family affair. His long-term production designer, Jack Fisk, was on board, as well as his wife, Sissy Spacek, to play the daughter of the man, who's played by Richard Farnsworth in one of his final role, an amazing role in a very long career. But also where it fits within Lynch's whole career is fascinating. The fact that it's called The Straight Story because the main character's called Alvin Straight, but there's a pun, because after all of these labyrinthine stories from Twin Peaks to Lost Highway, he finally tells something that's literally as straight as the road from Iowa to Wisconsin. But also the fact that he's already playing with so many of the tropes we expect from him. Wild at Heart and Lost Highway both have scenes of breakneck car journeys through the night. Lost Highway both starts and ends with these careening shots of headlights on the highway, and The Straight Story instead is characterized by these breezy, slow-paced shots of a lawnmower trundling along at a snail's pace. An amazing shot that is talked about in many reviews at the time. It's a bit, you know, almost over-talked about, but where you see Alvin Straight heading off into the sunset. There's an amazing crane pan up into the sky and a rising moment in the music, an amazing Angelo Badalamenti score sort of with country acoustic guitars and everything. And it pans back down and he's like literally moved a couple of inches because he's going so slowly rather than shooting off into the distance as you'd expect on a road movie. It's just such a wonderful film that often gets overlooked because we just see that Lynchian vibe takes us right through from Lost Highway straight into Mulholland Drive. But it feels to me so important because, as you said up top, Hannah, that this is a man who has many facets to him. And there's something that he clearly loves small town America. He really loves that greatest generation of the people who would have been in their 70s and 80s in the 90s. And it was a salute to many of his long-term collaborators. Freddie Francis, who shot Elephant Man amazingly, amazing cinematography in that movie, came back to shoot this and he was 80 or something, doing this road movie where they literally, almost like the new movie Nomadland, they actually just sort of as a whole équipe went across the road trip together. A really wonderful movie, I think. Do you guys agree? It's often overlooked sometimes in conversations about Lynch.
It's a great movie. Yeah, I only watched it for the first time very recently. Makes a nice double bill with Wild at Heart, of course. This is two like road movies, one much more fast-paced, though, say, for the other. But I was really surprised when I watched this because the first surprising thing was that there was a whole argument about this film with regards to Disney Plus. When Disney Plus launched, it was one of the few things that they didn't have in their back catalogue. And a lot of people kicked off and were like, where the hell is the straight story? which I hadn't realised. There was this whole like big argument because it was produced by Buena Vista. And yeah, they just kind of didn't really think anyone would be interested. So they didn't put it on Disney Plus. And then everyone kicked off and they did end up adding it a few weeks later, which is where it is now if people want to go and watch it. But yeah, I was so taken aback watching this for the first time a few months ago, I think just before Christmas actually, so not that long ago at all, by A, how straightforward it is, and B, just how kind of sweet and tender it is, which aren't necessarily words you would use, I think, very much with David Lynch, although he has moments of that in his work. I think this is the most kind of like just good people being good to each other story, and there's so many lovely moments when Alvin's on the road where he meets people who have all their own stories going on in the background, but they're just like, it's defined by these moments of like decency and understanding. And there's a moment where he's out there with his lawnmower and he's invited to stay at this it's either a couple's house or a motel, and he's just like, nope, I'm good right here where I am. And it's such a kind of like, I think your comparison to Nomadland is kind of like really apt. I think these two would work really well in a double bill because they are just about this like the kind of like almost frustrating determination of that generation of American citizens who were so determined to like kind of make it on their own and kind of saw like accepting any sort of form of help as like an affront to their American values. But there are all these like subtle kind of ways that people help him and like try to like, you know, kind of shimmy him along on this journey. And then I think like one of the greatest endings in cinema maybe of all time, like when he finally reaches his destination, spoiler alert, if you've not seen the film, he does make it. The exchange he has with his brother, who's played by Harry Dean Stanton, is just so like, it's just so beautiful. It's just, I won't spoil what they say to each other, but it's just such a like a poignant and like very true exchange to anyone who's like seen old men interact with each other. Like, I think just a very like accurate depiction of how that would go down. I think, yeah, it's a definite like a bit of an outlier, but at the same time, once you kind of look down and like go through it, you're like, oh no, actually this makes perfect sense that this is like, you know, a Lynch film.
Yeah, when Harry Dean Stanton died and he'd lived for another 16-17 years after this film, it was quite hard to pick the performances to put in his whatever top 10 for as a tribute, because so many of his performances are cameo size or supporting roles. He literally has like one line in this film and it just breaks your heart when it comes to it. And I just want to say something about Richard Farnsworth, because this character could easily be a Forrest Gumpy, very mannered Sean Penn in I Am Sam type kind of performance, but he has something about him. Maybe it's also the actual genuine vulnerability he has, because he was old. Alvin Strait was meant to be 73. I think Farnsworth was in his late 70s. He had had a hip replacement. He had had an accident. He was also very ill at the time, so there was a natural vulnerability. But there's a he's short in stature and has this very softly spoken voice, even though you could tell that in his day he would have been quite a strong-willed man. And so he can bring out these little kernels of wisdom and little turns of phrase when he says to one of the very kind people he meets on the way, "You're a kind man talking to a stubborn man." you can really get on his side, and it's that lightness of touch. In David Lynch's book, he says that Farnsworth originally turned it down, and they were thinking of going with John Hurt, mid-90s John Hurt, so would have been sort of acting older than he is, which I don't think would have... I mean, I love John Hurt, but wouldn't have worked at all, I don't think.
Well, he was quite ill, wasn't he, when they were filming, I think.
Mm.
And part of the fact he's in a lawnmower as well as being in the script is that he was unable to walk at some stage, and actually his injury had had some like hip surgeries, and was actually in not a very good state at all. So whether that, you know, aided his performance in any way, I don't know. But yeah, it's interesting. It's a while since I've seen the film, but it's kind of funny talking about it around or in between all these other much more, I guess, like, as we say, classically Lynchian films, and it's almost like positively experimental, you know, by comparison. And yeah, I just think it's a film that now that he's at this kind of age, Lynch, I'd love to see him go back and make something like this again, because I think it really shows what an amazing craftsman he is. And you know, I mean, Robert Zemeckis could never make a David Lynch film, but David Lynch could make a Robert Zemeckis film.
I agree with you there. I always think with The Straight Story that it's like it's a really good example of what a kind of natural, intuitive filmmaker he is. Like he just kind of whisks a bunch of scenes up. Each one is good and intriguing and different and brings some kind of new dynamic to the brew. But there's never a sense of like, oh, there's this big narrative unfolding and it's all connected and there's all these little things that kind of bolt together. And yet it always just feels like this kind of, you know, you never feel like you're kind of just on this random ambling journey. You know, it's like it feels like there is like purpose to everything. I always find with this film that it's just like every interaction he has with everyone is just delightful.
So, Adam, would you like to bring us home with your pick?
Yeah, it's maybe the most obvious one. But Mulholland Drive is a film that I think I've maybe seen more than any other of Lynch's. Actually, most recently, might have been the year before last, I think there was a 4K re-release and I went to see it. Went to see it at the Pictures Central, I think, quite a kind of late night showing. Took my missus along, and she'd never seen it before, so she's quite familiar with a lot of other Lynch, but that was one she hadn't ever sat down to, and so it was really nice actually watching it with her for the first time and having those discussions about the film afterwards. And I'd also seen it at the Prince Charles, I think, on 35mm back in the day, and I've like watched the DVD and watched it online, you know, a bunch of times. And yeah, it's just one of those films that every time I revisit it, there's something new that I discover about it, or something that I appreciate I maybe didn't appreciate as much, you know, the last time. And it's obviously seen as this amazing, seen as one of the kind of defining films of the current century. And I think the BBC, 3 or 4 years ago now, maybe, they did a kind of critics poll of the best films of the 21st century, and this came out as number one. But I think there's an argument to be said that it's actually the last really great film of the 20th century. And I think a lot of what Lynch is doing in this film is kind of harking back to, you know, this kind of old mode of Hollywood storytelling. There's a lot of comparisons that have been made to things like Sunset Boulevard, famous Billy Wilder film. And, you know, I think Lynch is very much a kind of student of people like Wilder, you know, and what he's doing, I think, in Mulholland Drive is tapping into a lot of the lore and a lot of the mythology that was kind of coming out of Hollywood at that time, and that subsequently has now been kind of put through this new lens and new filter by people like Lynch. And I guess someone like Quentin Tarantino, who we've mentioned a bit, albeit more populist in his kind of delivery, I think he does something quite similar as well a lot of the time. especially with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But yeah, I think Mulholland Drive is just one of those films that's, it doesn't feel like someone sat down and wrote the script and they cast it and got a load of people together and filmed it. It just feels like this thing that emerged already fully formed, right? And there's just so much going on. There's so much to it. And I think one of the things David was saying about earlier and the kind of recurring or overarching themes of Lynch's work and looking at kind of trauma and, you know, especially from a kind of female perspective. I think this is one of those films that people often talk about in terms of it being one of his most kind of oblique works, and it's very cryptic and it's this kind of strange puzzle to be solved. But I think if you kind of work backwards from it chronologically, I guess starting at the end where it's sort of revealed, however you want to read it, that, you know, Naomi Watts' character is kind of, a lot of what we've seen up to this point has been a kind of figment of her fractured kind of dream state. It becomes this very, very sad story, I think, and a really, you know, quite bleak outlook, I think, on this idea of Hollywood as, you know, I think what he's doing here basically is kind of deconstructing or breaking apart this myth of Hollywood as this kind of dream factory, right? And Naomi Watts' character, you know, people talk about it as a film about broken dreams, but I think what Lynch is interested in is the point past that where the dream has become this really like putrefied, really toxic, really like, you know, malicious thing that's actually infected her to the point that she's kind of having to create all these fantasies. And I think my favorite scene from the film, obviously there's all these like red herrings and non sequiturs and kind of weird scenes that stand on their own, but I think my favorite scene is the kind of boardroom scene with Justin Theroux's kind of hapless director and the film's producers and the kind of mafia boss that he meets, which I think when you kind of watch it and you go back chronologically through the film, it kind of feels like it can only be a product of Naomi Watts' imagination, right? Like this idea that she's ultimately wasn't cast in this film, like just as the amazing scene where she goes and gives that, it's almost like too good to be true performance in the casting, and you kind of realize that maybe that's not how it went down and she didn't get the role, and she's kind of dreamt up this scenario to explain why she was kind of shunned for this role. But yeah, I just think the way that scene is constructed and delivered, I mean, it is just like you're kind of on the edge of your seat, and then the payoff with the mafia boss being served this espresso and kind of like I think it's actually Angelo Badalamenti was cast as that character, and he kind of doesn't really say a lot, but his performance and that little delivery of him like spitting out the espresso, I mean, it is very, very funny. I think that's maybe something we haven't talked about all that much, is like Lynch is kind of seen as this quite not overly serious, but quite kind of like, you know, you're meant to meet him on this quite intellectual level, which is, I think, fair and true of a lot of his work. But yeah, I just think there's so much humour in his films as well. And maybe less so in Mulholland Drive than some other films, but moments like the espresso scene just kind of remind you how playful he can be, and also just a kind of master of the form. I mean, he is completely in control of every single, you know, minuscule detail of that scene, and it is just like so perfectly composed and delivered.
I remember when the DVD came out, it came with a little inlay with clues on how to unravel the mystery that just made the mystery more mysterious. It didn't help at all.
I think that's the point, right? I mean, it's like all the stuff with the blue box and all the Club Silencio stuff. It's kind of just, you know, there's clues there or whatever to the central mystery. But I think actually the narrative is a lot more kind of simple than all that. And there's all this stuff which is just there to kind of further... you know, he's just kind of layering up this intrigue and this mystique around the film, which is just that's very much a kind of Lynch trademark.
I think that going back to this idea of like unlocking the mystery, I think is something that people talk about a lot with Lynch, and you know, all the theories around Twin Peaks, and when The Return was on, all the kind of like constant, like it felt like it never ended, the like speculation. I think that one of the kind of things I like most about Lynch as a person is how like willing he is to play into this, and he's like, oh, you never know, which I really like. That I think totally speaks to that like playful side of him, which Adam's mentioned, in his sense of humor. And I think that this is something a lot of his like stars have picked up on and said in interviews. They've said kind of like, look, you know, it can mean whatever you want it to mean. It's like Lynch isn't playing fast and loose with that. He is quite happy for you to have your own interpretations of his work. And as a filmmaker and as an artist, he seems very like responsive to things meaning as little or as much as you want them to. There's a wonderful like meme which comes up on Twitter quite a lot of him saying, believe it or not, Lost Highway is my most spiritual film. And the interviewer says, elaborate on that. And he says, no. It's like my favorite kind of like, I have many favorite Lynchisms. I think he, you know, he has a wonderful kind of like sense of humor about his own work. But yeah, I think that especially with Mulholland Drive, which I still am not entirely sure I understand, it's one of the things I like most about him as someone who's quite like, I like understanding things, and I like knowing where I am with filmmakers. I am like constantly amazed at my capacity for bullshit with David Lynch. I'm like, yeah baby, take me on this journey, David. Like I'm totally here for it. I really think that he is very his honesty with how kind of like little you're going to understand is really refreshing in a filmmaker.
Yeah, I think that's almost, you know, a very roundabout way of kind of coming back to your thing about how you felt it was gatekept by these intellectual film bros who felt like they had to put their theories on all of this, when really, surely those gates should be thrown open, because they're such sensory, emotional, dreamlike, nightmarish experiences that you can take whichever way you want, surely.
And like, my mom isn't going to get the same thing out of a David Lynch film that I am. Like, she's not watching The Elephant Man and like looking for like the kind of like the deeper meaning. She's just like, wow, this is a really sad story with an amazing performance by Anthony Hopkins. And I love the idea that like you can come to David Lynch from a like a film bro point of view, or like a hardcore academic point of view, or you can come to it from kind of like a very casual, you know, just a person who just watches movies point of view, and have a totally different like understanding of the film and outlook on the film. And I think that's really refreshing, and we need more filmmakers like that, even though getting more filmmakers like David Lynch seems like quite a big ask.
Well, I think one interesting thing, and one thing you can, you know, for whatever reading there is available in Mulholland Drive, and whatever you want to, however you want to interpret it, you can discern certain things from it that I think speak to his own experiences in the industry. And like, actually that espresso scene for me is quite a kind of, you know, thinly veiled jab at that kind of stuffy boardroom executive level meeting that must happen. And I'm sure he's been in many, and obviously famously Mulholland Drive was intended as a kind of TV series. And they shot this pilot, which ABC basically like rejected, and it was kind of then upon Lynch to sort of flesh out the ending and salvage it and turn it into this amazing film. And so I think, you know, there's a lot in there about his own experiences and his own kind of views towards Hollywood and the whole system, and kind of taken, I guess, this sort of loose LA trilogy that it forms, and it's sort of the middle film, right, with Lost Highway and Inland Empire. And I think all of those films, if you look at it from the point of view of like what it tells you about, you know, the film industry and kind of Lynch's position and role within it, and the position and role of filmmakers like Lynch within it, it's and especially now in hindsight, kind of looking at what Hollywood looks like now and what the state of the industry is, I think it's quite revealing.
So listeners, there you have it, four very personal recommendations from the filmography of David Lynch, and lots of roots into his other work beyond that. If you've watch these films, or if you're going to watch these films, if you have a big theory about what it all means, or just about David Lynch's films in general, let us know at the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email, or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. David, Adam, Hannah, thank you so much for talking Lynch with me today. I'm Michael Leader, and you'll hear again from us soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.